From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Some news you have to dig for. Other news, powered by a winch and sheer national will, literally rises to the surface.
A group of miners trapped underground for 17 days are still alive. The men
drill that it's hoped will save the lives of 33 miners trapped half a mile underground in Chile makes its first bite into the soil.
A cage specially built to help rescue 33 men trapped underground in a mine in Chile has arrived at the mine head.
People from around this country, from around the world, watching live video underground as the rescue, unprecedented in the world's history, takes place.
The world was transfixed and elated this week by the television rescue of 33 men who had been trapped for 69 days more than 2,000 feet underground in a Chilean mine, 17 of those days starving in darkness. The presidents of Chile and Bolivia were there, the families were there in a makeshift desert campground called Hope. More than 2,000 media personnel were there, and a billion TV viewers worldwide. It was the World Cup of empathy, the moon landing of extrication. We cheered, we cried. The miners' liberation was our liberation. Even cable stopped shouting, shilling, and obsessing for one magnificent day.
Here we go. There it is. Bravo, success. He's made it to the surface. Wow. It worked. It worked just like they said. It worked.
There is a silly commonplace along the lines of, we need one day a week when the media report only good news, which is something like, we need one day a week when we replace medicine with candy. But let me tell you, the mine rescue was candy. Sweet, delicious, and most importantly, bite-sized candy. No wonder the photographers and reporters stampeded over Camp Hope, hoping to get a glimpse of the ascending folk heroes. No wonder the agents and promoters were on hand, offering movie contracts and product endorsements and tell-all publicity deals to the ascending celebrities. No wonder the miners had to sign an all-for-one, one-for-all pact to share all proceeds of their stories. And no wonder Chilean authorities had to censor media going into the mine and coming out, lest some bit of unmediated unpleasantness trigger a freakout below ground or above. This is a rescue operation, the general manager of the mining company was quoted as saying, not a reality show. Oh, yes, it was. The whole world now knows of the love triangle. One miner's wife in a nervous vigil adjacent to the nervous vigil of the same miner's girlfriend. The whole world knows who among the miners was the scared one, who was the wise one, who was the sick one, who was the depressed one, who was the funny one. The world even knows that some of what happened 2,000 feet below was so awful that the sacred pact includes secrets to be taken to the grave. How yummy. Plus, the whole story was self-contained, which is to say, easy and relatively cheap to report, although the BBC has said that its £100,000 invested in the Chilean rescue may limit its coverage of other events, such as the G20 and the Oscars. But the point is, the money paid for reporters on the scene reporting. Of course, cable news is still cable news, so tell me, Fox's Steve Harrigan, 33 lives are being saved before our eyes. How do you feel?
You know, emotion is contagious, and this is an unusual kind of emotion, I think, for journalists to be around where people are really thrilled.
Thanks,
really
Steve. Happy. And tomorrow on Fox?
A young hunter fights for his life when four bears attack. 21-year-old Chad Fortune was bow hunting deer in Michigan. While he was in a tree stand, the bears climbed up after
him. This story of trapped miners had the happiest of endings, but you don't have to cast your mind back very far to see how rare that outcome is. In January 2006, a coal mine exploded in Sago, West Virginia, and mining officials released incorrect information. So many media outlets reported that 12 of the 13 trapped men had survived. In fact, only one had. Agony. There are disasters every day, born of disease, floods, fire, starvation. So what is it about mine disasters that captures our horrified imaginations? Journalism is a business that thrives by reflecting the public's hopes and dreams and nightmares. And what's more primal than being trapped without air or light or sound in a living death? Any story that can penetrate that purgatory, any reporter who can send a dispatch from that no man's land between life and death, will always draw an audience. History tells us that the public will always respond to stories about people trapped in holes. Several years ago, NPR's Mike Pesca looked back on the dramatic history of this most literal variety of underground journalism.
Man, or men, or sometimes babies trapped underground, has been a story for as long as people have been telling stories, or at least selling them in newspapers or broadcasting them. There was the case of Floyd Collins.
You never heard of Floyd Collins?
That's Kirk Douglas in the 1951 movie Ace in the Hole. He plays a journalist who stumbles across a man trapped in a cave. Here he reminds a Cub reporter about a similar story.
Floyd Collins, doesn't that ring a bell?
No, not to me it doesn't.
1925, Kentucky, the guy pinned way down in that cave. One of the biggest stories that ever broke. Front page in every paper in the country for weeks.
Maybe I did hear about it.
Maybe you heard that a reporter on the Louisville paper crawled in for the story and came out with a Pulitzer Prize.
It's true. The 1926 Pulitzer Prize for reporting was awarded to William Burke Miller of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Miller, known as Skeets, became a character in the 1995 musical Floyd Collins, which dealt with the drama in the cave and the chaos in the newsroom.
K City, comma, capital K, capital Y, February 4th.
According to Skeets Miller, comma, Collins is quickly slipping into a state of deep despair.
Asking for milk.
The trapped man was heard to cry out, folks, get me out of here, comma, even if you have to tear my foot off. Explanation, close quote.
Floyd is reported to be in a state of delirium, conversing with the cave crickets and even begging them to hurry, 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 call me out.
A little more than a decade after Floyd Collins, reporter J. Frank Willis of the Canadian Radio Commission covered the collapse of the Moose River Mine in Nova Scotia, Canada.
It is a broken country down here, drab and desolate. A country of scrub and second growth, of rock. Rock, relentless, hard, cruel hard. It is against rock of this sort that miners for the past week have fought and fought, grim-lipped, determined, and are winning their fight. Inch by inch, the rock is retreating.
Today, news networks never leave these stories. Even if little is happening on the scene, time will be filled with talking heads, recovery experts, and, in the absence of that, speculation. Willis, however, was fiercely committed to the notion that only that which was newsworthy should be broadcast.
The rumor has gone abroad and has been published as a fact that the mine is in danger of caving in. This is absolutely not true. We're standing here, we can spit into this pit, and yet, from thousands of miles away, people are contradicting what we have to say. This must stop. I'm stopping these broadcasts now until something definite happens.
One man died, two survived. The Moose River cave-in was one of the first times that radio displayed its power to connect with listeners on a real-life event occurring in real time. A decade later, TV would demonstrate that ability in its coverage of yet another person trapped in a hole. In 1949, 3-year-old Kathy Fiscus fell into a well near Los Angeles. Local station KTLA's round-the-clock coverage was groundbreaking in that it proved TV could find ample drama outside the scripted world of the studio. In fact, it was a KTLA reporter who informed her family that Kathy had died. Her grave marker reads, "A little girl who brought the world together for a moment." Almost 40 years later, there was another moment. Another little girl was trapped in a well, Jessica McClure. Mary Alice Williams was one of CNN's primary anchors in 1987.
We were the only ones on the air when this 18-month-old baby girl fell into a well. And suddenly, all the huge international stories melted away. Of course, many, many hours later, the broadcast networks caught on to the drama of this event.
We were still rather looked down on by the other networks. They didn't consider us to be equals.
Bob Fernad was CNN's vice president and senior producer during the Jessica McClure rescue.
Our ratings shot up as people left the three broadcast networks, assuming correctly so that they do the story and then go back to their regular programming and that we'd stay with it. and our ratings spiked, and for the first time, we beat the three broadcast networks in eyeballs.
And that's what made the Jessica McClure story a watershed for CNN. It confirmed what was an operating theory, that this new way of covering a story, wall to wall, was the formula for success. However, former anchor Mary Alice Williams thinks cable news took the wrong lesson from the little girl in the well.
What it led to was the wall-to-wall coverage of O.J. Simpson. And the motive for watching O.J. was pure prurience. There was no other reason. It was a collective schadenfreude. Look how the mighty have fallen. Baby Jessica wasn't that. It was the opposite. It was a collective hope, a collective prayer to save a person's life, a baby's life.
Such is the fine line in TV news between pathos and bathos, between bathos and exploitation. It's not a happily ever after story for the rest of the Jessica McClure participants either. Jessica herself still lives in Texas, plays the French horn, and makes A's and B's in school. She has a trust fund in excess of $1 million. The only interview she does is with Ladies Home Journal, which recently revealed that Jessica has juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Her parents, teenagers at the time, divorced. Her rescuer, Robert O'Donnell, couldn't handle the stress of having been a hero in the world's eyes, only to see the spotlight snatched away so quickly. He bored co-workers with endless stories of his time in the hole, squabbled with fellow rescuers over payment for the TV movie, developed a dependence on prescription painkillers, and in 1995 took his own life with a shotgun blast to the head. Perhaps most interesting is what happened to Skeets Miller, who interviewed Floyd Collins in 1925. He left Louisville soon after he won his Pulitzer and moved to radio. By 1947, he was at NBC, where he served as assignment editor for the company's newest venture, television. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Oh, come on, you young people, and listen while I tell the fate of Floyd Collins.
Coming up, the political lies we love to hate.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly, and politicians, come on, say it with me, gotta occasionally lie.
Read my lips.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
The world knows that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction.
When Hillary Clinton was running for the Democratic nomination for president in 2008, she had this to say about a trip she took to Bosnia 12 years earlier.
I remember landing under sniper fire. There was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles.
Only when video of Clinton's visit to Bosnia surfaced, it showed no such sniper fire or running with her head down or any danger of the sort. She said later she misspoke. Fibs, fabrications, untruths, call them what you want, but why do media seem to care a lot more about some political lies than about others? American Prospect senior correspondent Paul Waldman thinks he knows why and has developed a few rules for candidates to consider when dealing with the press. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brooke.
So one of your rules goes something like this. Lying about yourself is worse than lying about your opponent, as far as the press is concerned. Why?
There's an assumption that part of the role of the political reporter is to kind of get behind the veneer of politics and show us the self that they are trying to keep hidden.
But I would think it would be equally revealing if you knew that a particular candidate was spending a lot of time lying about their opponent.
I agree with you. But for some reason, the lies about the opponent aren't taken as seriously as the lies that a candidate tells about him or herself. There have been a couple of candidates this year who have gotten in a great deal of trouble when they told stories about themselves that turned out not to be exactly right. One is Richard Blumenthal, the Democratic nominee for Senate in Connecticut, who it was discovered on a number of occasions implied or said that he served in Vietnam.
We have learned something very important since the days that I served in Vietnam, and you exemplify it.
When in fact he was in the reserves and served during Vietnam, which is obviously a very different thing. Once that came out, there was a big investigation. People went through and looked through all of his old statements to try to find other cases where he had said it or implied it. His opponent, Linda McMahon, is now airing ads that say,
if he lied about Vietnam, what else is he lying about?
Linda McMahon, who's associated with World Wrestling Entertainment, she hasn't exactly been in a field that is renowned for honesty.
No, they do an even better job at theater than politicians do. But that question that she asks in her ad, if he's lying about this, what else is he lying about, is one that actually reporters ask all the time, either explicitly or implicitly. But the problem is that it never actually gets answered. And it's a reasonable question. That's supposed to be the whole reason why we're concerned about this, right? That if a liar sort of gets through the election without us realizing it, that in office, that character flaw will have some kind of impact on the performance of their official duties. For instance, Mark Kirk, who's a Senate candidate in Illinois, he's a Republican, has gotten caught exaggerating his own military record.
Mark Kirk coming under fire this morning for reportedly claiming a military award that he didn't actually earn.
For years, Kirk has claimed that he was named the U.S. Navy's Intelligence Officer of the Year. Turns out that is not quite true.
It's not that we should be excusing that, but we should be wondering, what exactly does this tell us about what kind of a senator each of those people might make? And then we can judge whether we think that ought to be disqualifying.
So let's return briefly to the double standard here, that lying about your opponent is seen as something of business as usual. Is there no lie that one can tell about a rival that would cause the media to stir? Can you think of no example that brought a candidate down?
I don't know that I can. Most of the criticisms candidates make about their opponents tend to revolve around policies, actually, and they can get away with really wild exaggerations. And that's the second thing that I wrote about, that it's seen as more acceptable to lie about policy than it is to lie about personal matters. And that can apply to some degree whether you're talking about your opponent's policies or your own policies. Part of it has to do with the fact that people who are covering campaigns aren't necessarily policy experts. They're more interested in the sort of strategic questions: who's going to win, what do the polls say. They seem to be less interested in delving into those details to say that, you know, this candidate's tax plan is really just a parade of deceptions, and that should tell us something about what his tax policy is going to be like if he ought to get elected.
So what you're saying is that the media have less expertise to evaluate a policy charge, and anyone is an expert when it comes to personal matters. But, I mean, you're not excusing it on those grounds, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Quite the contrary. Perhaps the lies about policy are the ones that are more consequential. For instance, in the healthcare debate that just happened, Sarah Palin came out and said that the Affordable Care Act included a provision for death panels that might condemn her disabled child to death. Now, that was a lie, and it was an extremely pernicious one that had definite effects. The provision in question, which did nothing of the sort, but actually could have been valuable in helping people plan end-of-life care, that provision got removed from the bill amid all the controversy. And that whole death panel argument almost brought down the whole bill. But what we didn't see was a big discussion about, well, you know, if Sarah Palin lied about that, what other kinds of lies would she tell? Those sorts of questions don't really get asked. When you tell a lie about policy, the discussion tends to revolve around what you did. Was that over the line? When you lie about a personal matter about yourself, the question that gets asked is not what did he do, but who is he?
Give me an example of a president who paid a higher price for a personal lie than for a policy lie.
Well, let's take the contrast between Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. We all know that Vietnam brought down Johnson's presidency, but when we think about him prowling the corridors of the White House at night, brooding about Vietnam, and it ultimately being the reason that he decided not to run for re-election. Even though it's widely understood that he told the American public many, many things about how the war was going that were false.
It is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
The dominant remembrance that we have of Johnson is not that he was a liar. Nixon, on the other hand, near the end of Watergate, came out, looked into the cameras and said,
people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
He told the public a lie, not about what he had done or what he hadn't done, about what a policy was. He made that statement about who he was. And I think that's part of the reason why it's sort of burned into our memory about Nixon. And it ties in with this kind of general theme of all political coverage, but especially coverage of campaigns, which is that the most important thing is character. That you're not voting for a set of policies, a set of votes on bills, but that you're voting for a human being. And the most important thing to know is whether they embody those kinds of personal virtues that supposedly go all the way back to George Washington. When reporters are going to say things like, this statement that the candidate made raises questions, the questions that are most relevant to what they're going to do in that office that they're running for are the ones that should be focused on.
You're asking them to focus on the relevant.
It's a tall order, I know.
Paul, thank you so much.
Goes against every instinct they have.
Paul Waldman is a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. And now we consider deceptions of campaigns past. Greg Mitchell, the Media Fix columnist for The Nation magazine, recently reflected on a momentous election. Quote, nearly 2 years after a Democrat promising hope and change entered the White House, amid an economic crisis left behind by an unpopular Republican, unemployment remained at century-high levels. Yet, as a midterm election approached, one that might decide whether the president and his programs had much of a future, right-wing demagogues on the stump and in the media accused the White House of imposing socialism on America. Unquote. The election Greg Mitchell is referring to occurred in 1934, one of the most closely watched state races in the country, one that seemed to serve as a referendum on FDR's New Deal. It was the race for the governorship of California, and seemingly out of nowhere, a Democratic candidate won the primary who might rightly have been accused of socialism. He was longtime muckraker and author and recent socialist Upton Sinclair, and he'd started a hugely popular anti-poverty campaign.
There's no excuse for poverty in a state as rich as California. We can produce so much food that we have to dump it into our bay.
Mitchell says that the backlash to Sinclair's primary win was swift and terrible, ushering in the first modern media campaign. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
So in your preface, you describe Upton Sinclair as a muckraking author, militant vegetarian, erstwhile socialist, and scourge of the ruling class. Given those descriptors, how had Sinclair won the primary for California governor in 1934 to begin with?
Well, he decided he had written enough and decided to change his affiliation from socialist and enter the Democratic primary. He led a mass movement called End Poverty in California, or EPIC, and managed to sweep the Democratic primary in a landslide with hundreds of thousands of votes and was the favorite to win in November.
So people knew who they were voting for.
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the most famous authors in the world. Today, we remember him mainly for The Jungle, but at the time, he was always in and out of the headlines, getting arrested, and was certainly a famous figure in California and around the country.
As you describe it, the swiftest response to his winning the primary came from newspaper magnates like William Randolph Hearst and the Chandlers,
right,
the family behind the Los Angeles Times, and also Hollywood.
Well, of course, the newspapers at that time were extremely reactionary throughout the state. They were owned by families. They had a lot of money at stake. And, you know, Sinclair, bless his heart, had been one of the leading media critics of his day. We think of Sinclair today as this muckraker, like an investigative journalist or something. He was mainly a novelist, and even The Jungle is a novel. So what the newspapers would do is they would take some outrageous thing that a character in one of Sinclair's novels said and would pretend that Sinclair had said it himself. So they would put it right on the front page and have him believing in free love and giving away money to everyone and hating the church. So yeah, the newspapers were in the forefront of the fight.
The Los Angeles Times also took shots at Sinclair's followers.
Yeah, they called him the maggot-like horror then. It was so over the top.
The political editor of the Los Angeles Times was a real kingmaker. His name was Kyle Palmer. And you cite this really amazing anecdote
when he's having a conversation with the New York Times' star reporter, right, who was in California, a guy named Turner Catledge.
Turner came out there to cover the campaign in a fairly even-handed way, and was amazed there was no coverage about Sinclair at all in the LA Times, except for all the negative shots. And so he asked Kyle Palmer, how can you get away with only covering one campaign? And Palmer said, Turner, forget it. We don't go in for that kind of crap that you have back in New York of being obliged to print both sides. We're going to beat this son of a bitch, Sinclair, any way we can. We're going to kill him.
Quote, unquote. Okay, so what was Hollywood's beef with Upton Sinclair?
They thought that Sinclair and his former socialistic background was a threat to the movie industry itself. And so the first thing they did was they threatened to move to Florida. When that didn't work, they docked each of their employees one day's pay to be donated then to the GOP candidate. And then finally, Irving Thalberg at MGM made these newsreels that presented Sinclair and his supporters in the worst possible light and were actually mainly faked footage. Some of it was shot on the studio lot. They hired actors to portray bums and other Sinclair supporters.
This was the famous humanitarian, Irving Thalberg?
Yeah. He admitted it after the campaign that he was the one. And I managed to find these newsreels. They were sort of missing to history. They were really the first attack ads on the screen. And people back then got a lot of their news off the newsreels, and they thought they were the straight deal.
You say that this campaign marked the beginning of media politics. I want you to make that argument for me, because certainly negative advertising did not begin with the gubernatorial campaign of Upton Sinclair.
There, of course, had been dirty campaigns before this, but campaigns had always been run by political parties and their local leaders. But the Sinclair threat was so great, they turned the campaign over for the first time to what we now call political consultants, to PR people we now call spin doctors. This is the first turning over of the campaign to advertising people. The use of radio and the screen to make attack ads and national fundraising from all over the country in one state race. All of those things were unprecedented.
What was the substance of these smears that made it so unprecedented?
Sinclair said that if he was elected, California would become such a paradise that the unemployed would want to come to California. And of course, he was just joking about it. But they took that and they made radio dramas around it. They made two of these fake newsreels around it. They plastered it on billboards all over the state.
Horrific images of huddled masses,
right,
crowding into California.
Your inquiring cameraman interviewed 30 stated that they were on their way to California to spend the winter and to remain there permanently if the epic plan went into effect.
Hearst owned movie theaters, so he worked with MGM to get these newsreels into his movie theaters. He had all these people on every level of radio, newspapers, movies, advertising, all in the same room and saying, okay, how can we direct this campaign using all these different tools?
You're describing a sort of vertical integration of the political smear.
That's right, yeah. One of the things that was continually used against Sinclair was that he was a free love advocate, some sort of wild living radical, almost what you might call a hippie bohemian and so forth. This was because there were characters in his books who had these traits. He was a vegetarian, you know, which at that time was seen as somehow un-American. So he had some personal traits, but the odd thing was he was such a straight-laced, not in any way a free spirit that they pictured him as. So many people had moved to California from the Midwest, and the Dust Bowl is a big, big church-going state. So Sinclair certainly was looked down upon by many of those people.
So were you convinced that it was the negative advertising that took down Upton Sinclair?
I think after coming off his primary win, which is at the very end of August, the Epic campaign was an incredible mass movement. I mean, they had 800 chapters around the state. They had a weekly newspaper that had 2 million circulation. I would say that if these new techniques and over-the-top, incredible, dirty tricks had not been employed, that Sinclair would have narrowly won.
It strikes me that if lying during a campaign is a crime against democracy, then what this campaign of Upton Sinclair teaches us is that crime pays.
Well, we certainly see to this day the attack ads, you know, this year as much as ever, and there's all kinds of new money coming into campaigns. One thing that's different, I would say, is today a lot of the campaign tricks eventually get exposed. We've seen any number of races in recent years that have sort of turned on YouTube videos or some sort of blog exposés. We just saw this fall the rather humorous case of the Republican campaign in West Virginia, which shot a commercial with supposed to be average folks sitting around a diner and trashing the Democratic candidate. Via the web and other sources, it was discovered that they had sent out a casting call for actors. They called hickey-looking actors. So I thought of the Thalberg hiring of bums for the newsreels. This commercial was dropped in West Virginia because it had been exposed. It's a neck-and-neck race, so I guess we'll see what happens.
Greg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Greg Mitchell writes the Media Fix column for The Nation, and a new edition of his book, The Campaign of the Century, is out now.
Coming up, a look back at TV 60 years ago and 5 minutes ago.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth in foster care, on the web at aecf.org. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Recapping, the internet phenomenon of writing synopses of TV shows and movies as soon as they're seen has exploded in popularity in recent years. And while some websites stick to the straight play-by-play summaries, the best recappers are snarky and smart, engaged in celebrating a show's weakness as much as summarizing its plot. The recapping phenomenon began in earnest in the late 90s when two TV junkies started a website called Television Without Pity, which served up hilarious, meandering meditations on Dawson's Creek. But the New York Observer noted last month that it wasn't until 2007 that recapping achieved major internet penetration. That's when Gawker began recapping the primetime teen soap opera Gossip Girl, and NBC Universal bought Television Without Pity. Finally, recapping was recognized as an entertainment genre in its own right, one that could really draw a crowd. Richard Lawson recaps a number of shows for Gawker, including Gossip Girl. "It's a show," writes Lawson, "that plays as if, quote, written by drunk chimpanzees wearing old-timey green accountant visors, smoking Marlboro Ultralight 100s. Richard, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob. Thanks.
Recaps do recapitulate the events of a TV program, but usually, and certainly in your case, they do so much more. Why do you recap shows?
I guess it's to continue a conversation that starts the night that you watch the show. It's kind of a water cooler conversation writ large, I guess.
So strictly speaking, you're not filling people in who have missed the show and just need to be caught up. You're writing from the point of view that whoever your audience is actually seeing the episode that you're writing about.
There are certain shows that I recap, like American Idol, that are competition shows where, yeah, if you miss an episode, you could read what happened, you know, the next day. But yeah, largely, I think it's for an audience that is maybe a little obsessive about whatever show we're talking about. And so we can get really into some silly nitty gritty about the program.
Tell me about your approach when you recap, let's just say, Gossip Girl.
Gossip Girl is an example of something that I don't honestly love to watch, but I have a ton of fun writing about it. Certainly my disdain for the actual show does seep into the recaps pretty heavily.
Seep in?
Yeah.
Seep in.
Yeah. Okay, maybe overtakes.
It's more like the red Hungarian sludge that overtakes the town.
The closest example, and it's a kind of a strange example, is people who are obsessed with celebrities who end up kind of wanting to kill them. It's a kind of ardent fervor for this show that, and you know, it turns out that I just end up trashing it because there's nothing left to do.
You're getting in touch with your inner Mark David Chapman.
I guess so, yeah. I don't really have a Jodie Foster to try to impress, but something like that, yeah.
Even though you're taking off after Gossip Girls, Do the producers and do the CW network despise you, or are they delighted that you're doing this in order to attract more audience to their program?
People behind the scenes of the shows tend to just enjoy the attention no matter what. You know, if I didn't like the show in some strange way, I wouldn't keep watching and I wouldn't keep writing about it. I do Real Housewives recaps for, you know, the Bravo series. And I've met some higher-ups at Bravo who really like that I do them, even though I'm saying some not-so-kind things about the show. Until recently, I've never really gotten any kind of backlash. There was an incident with one of the housewives on the most recent iteration of the show where she was pretty upset about some things that I had written about her. But by and large, I think that it's almost as if our show is on Tuesday night, but then on Wednesday morning, we get another little bit of attention from all the recappers.
Years ago, we interviewed the founders of Television Without Pity. They mentioned that they believed that the writers of the show were actually kind of acknowledging their recaps by inserting sort of sly nods to the recapitulation process in the stories themselves. Do you see that as actually taking place?
I mean, I've seen it. Unfortunately, they haven't done it for me, but New York Magazine's Daily Intel website does some pretty exhaustive Gossip Girl recaps, and they've mentioned them sort of in a subtle way. And I know that on entertainmentweekly.com, there was a recapper who did recaps of the OC, that Fox show, and they pretty obliquely like just mentioned her in the show, and then they gave her a favorite prop from the series. In my case, I think I might be a little bit too hard on the show sometimes to really get their attention in a positive way, but who knows?
So what are you? Are you, in fact, an entertainment journalist?
No, I wouldn't say so. I'm a writer, and I write fiction, and I write plays and poetry and all that other stuff. And the recapping stuff, the blogging stuff is fun, different, and in my case, really unexpected. There's a lot of room. You know, it's kind of frontier territory in terms of what you can do and what people are willing to accept.
You know, with the fragmentation of media, the notion of 50% of the entire country watching an episode of Gunsmoke and then talking about it at the water cooler the next day, that's gone. But the desire for communal experience is not gone. So you're just kind of a facilitator for people doing what people do.
If you look at any of the posts on Gawker, really the discussion of the show in earnest takes place in the comments. So if nothing else, I'm at least providing a kind of springboard for readers and commenters to point out little details that they thought were funny. And they always get very excited either when I mention something that they're like, oh, yeah, I did notice that. Or, you know, another commenter says it. It's that kind of shared recognition that someone else across the country was sitting down and watching the same thing you were.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Aleppa.
Richard Lawson is a staff writer for Gawker.com, where he recaps.
The power of television to shape our view of America was noted even when the medium was a relative infant. We think of a simpler time of nuclear families in black and white, well, actually almost entirely white, of fathers who knew best and problems neatly resolved in 30 minutes minus the commercials. Media historian Eric Burns has written a book called Invasion of the Mind Snatchers. That's a history of TV's emergence in the 50s. He charts not only the invention of TV, but also the social context surrounding its birth, a reality far more turbulent than that depicted on the small screen. As he recounts, the very birth of television was marked by conflict. David Sarnoff, a longtime RCA executive, has often been credited with TV's invention, but now we know the credit should probably go to a man named Philo T. Farnsworth, a precocious young inventor blessed with a love of electronics, but cursed with a disastrous dearth of business sense. Farnsworth fought a long and fruitless battle to protect the patents on his technological discoveries, a battle already lost when he gave what seemed to be a nice Russian enthusiast a tour of his factory.
A man named Vladimir Zworykin was a kind of spy for Sarnoff, and in fact once went to Farnsworth's lab and pretended to be just someone who was fascinated with Farnsworth's ideas. Farnsworth, in all innocence, gave Zworykin a tour, told him everything he could about television, and as soon as Zworykin finished the tour, he stole Farnsworth's ideas, gave them to Sarnoff, and that was the beginning of a battle of lawsuits that lasted for decades.
So, TV is invented one way or another, and it takes off. One of the most fascinating parts of the book for me was the fact that the kind of skepticism that people might apply to what they heard on the radio seemed to get suspended when they saw it on TV.
One of the most popular shows in the 50s was Our Miss Brooks. Eve Arden starred as a school teacher.
I'm Miss Brooks of Madison High. I teach English.
Yeah, we don't want none, ma'am.
Well, I don't want none neither, but it's a living.
The show was very successful, and after a few years, she got offers to teach in American high schools. People believed either that she was really a teacher or that in preparing for the role, that she could be a teacher just because of the research she had done. People who starred in Westerns were asked what it was like to travel through Indian country. People who starred in shows about outer space were asked if travel from one galaxy to another was tiring for them.
Let's talk about the evolution of the relationship between television and advertising. Back in those days, the sponsors of television shows were very much identified with the programs.
There were dozens and dozens of shows, Philco, General Electric, virtually all of them sponsoring dramatic shows and exerting almost unimaginable control over the content. For instance, Camel Cigarettes sponsored a newscast with John Cameron Swayze as the anchor. And although Swayze smoked during the show refused to cover the stories of the link between cancer and cigarettes. It went so far that a television producer once was told not to have a character say, "Ford a river," because the show was sponsored by Chevrolet. It was absurd, and in some cases, it was very troubling.
There's the famous example of the American Gas Company sponsoring a teleplay of the Judgment of Nuremberg about the trial of the Nazis involved in the Holocaust.
It was the American Gas Association, which at the time was a virtually unknown trade group, and it wanted to get some A, notice, and B, prestige. The show was filmed, but it didn't occur to anybody with the Gas Association until after it was filmed that it was gas that was the implement used by the Nazis. And when the American Gas Association realized this, of course, it wasn't American Gas Association gas that the Nazis used, but they were horrified. And what they did was simply take out the word gas every time it was mentioned in the show, and it was mentioned often, so that a character's lips would move and there would be a nanosecond of silence.
So they were sent to the pause chambers.
Yes, pause, lip flap, chambers.
Let's talk about race and television. What were the portrayals of African Americans on TV in the 50s and 60s?
Entertainment television reflected a lot of negative attitudes about blacks, and there was a great desire not to offend racists. Television journalism, on the other hand, was never so noble as it was in the 50s, because that was when television journalism put aside its apprehensions and covered the racial disturbances in the South in a manner that I think was more compelling to Americans, more powerful to Americans in forming racial attitudes than was Lyndon Johnson's Civil Rights Act of the mid-60s.
Meanwhile, in entertainment programming, there was a version of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn without Jim. There was a story about Emmett Till written by Rod Serling, which the network forced him to set in New England with Till not as a young black man, but as a white adult. I mean, the whole thing was completely wrecked.
It may be the worst single example of television giving in to an outside force that I've ever encountered. The force in this case was Southern racists. Emmett Till was a young black boy who had been savagely murdered in the South when he was visiting there. The jury knew that the two men on trial were guilty. They were immediately acquitted. As a matter of fact, the verdict took 2 hours to reach. A juror said we would have come out a lot quicker, but we had a few soft drinks while we were in the jury room. When Rod Serling wrote his teleplay of Emmett Till, he was a white man from another country who came to New England. The story made no sense whatsoever, and Serling, he was just mortified by what he had done. 4 years after this, he got the idea for a show called The Twilight Zone, and his career was salvaged. But he could never get the taint of the Emmett Till teleplay out of his mind.
Let's talk about women on TV. They didn't fare so well either.
Women and blacks were treated similarly. Both were very often background figures who, when they moved to the foreground, were shown to be the inferiors of white males. The interesting irony is that one woman who watched some of these shows was so angry that she wrote an article for TV Guide about this treatment of women and expanded it into a book called The Feminine Mystique. The woman was Betty Friedan, and most people who have studied the matter will tell you that The Feminine Mystique was, in fact, the start of the women's movement.
Let's move to another genre. I remember when I was a very small kid, I saw some episodes of a most peculiar program called Queen for a Day, where women would come on, compete for who had the worst life, and the one who won got a refrigerator.
There were two shows that really stood out in this genre. Queen for a Day was one of them, and another show was called Strike It Rich. Queen for a Day employed what was called a misery meter. At the end of the show, the audience voted by applauding on which woman had told the most sorrowful story. And that woman got, if possible, what she asked for.
I crown you Queen for a Day, Queen Viva Burt.
One woman on Queen for a Day said she needed someone to come in and put a hole in her ceiling. She said, the only heat we have is on the first floor. Our children sleep on the second floor. So we wanted to put a hole in the ceiling so the heat could go up and heat the children's bedroom. Well, this woman won and got a new furnace instead of a hole in the ceiling.
So you close the book with a scene of Philo T. Farnsworth in the late 50s as a guest on a quiz show.
Yes.
It was called I've Got a Secret. And in this case, the contestants on the show had to guess who Farnsworth was. It's such a bizarre scene.
Philo T. Farnsworth came on I've Got a Secret, and his secret was that he had invented television.
Now, we're not going to identify this contestant panel because to identify him would be to tip off his secret. We will call him simply Dr. X.
The panelists were stumped.
Do you work in any kind of a laboratory or a place like that?
Yes.
Would this remotely or in any way be connected with psychiatric cases?
No, not especially.
They had no idea who he was, so Farnsworth went away shaking his head with his $80 in cash prizes and his Winston cigarettes because he had stumped the panel with his anonymity.
One of the questions a panelist asks is, you say you're an inventor. Does your invention cause people pain?
Is this some kind of a machine that might be painful when it's used?
Sometimes it's most painful.
Farnsworth had come rather quickly to disdain the medium he created. At one point, he had 8 televisions in his house, and none of them worked, and that was by intent. Vladimir Zworykin was similarly offended by the medium.
This was Sarnoff's spy you talked about at the beginning of the interview.
Sarnoff's spy. He was asked by an interviewer on one occasion what he was most pleased with on television, and he said, Das Witch. And the interviewer said, pardon me. Zworykin still had a very thick Russian accent. He repeated, the switch, so I can turn the damn thing off.
Thank you so much, Eric.
I'm happy to have been here, Brooke.
Eric Burns is a cultural historian, and his book is called The Invasion of the Mind Snatchers, Television's Conquest of America in the 50s.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Zwolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Nerida Brownlee and Bonnie Watt, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Robert Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our big kahuna. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
That's incredible! Hill Street Blues! Dallas! Wednesday! We sit glued to the TV set all night! And every night! Why go into the outside world at all?
On the Media is supported by iContact, an email marketing firm dedicated to community empowerment. iContact offers email marketing service and solutions to qualified nonprofits. Learn more at iContact.com/giving. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.